Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The Pelvic Messenger, the show that dives into the world of chronic pelvic pain. The Pelvic Messenger brings to you a fair and balanced message of hope. Empower yourself with the knowledge, understanding, and tools to best manage your pelvic problems and pain. My own personal struggles with endometriosis, interstitial cystitis, and pelvic floor dysfunction have led me to be an advocate and a voice for all of the diseases, syndromes, and complexities of the pelvis. It is with great empathy and compassion that I bring this show to you. Enjoy the next hour, and together let us learn and inspire one another. Together we can create real and lasting change. The content of this show and the website for Pelvic Messenger are for informational purposes only and are not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding concerns and medical conditions.
Everyone, thank you for joining us today for another very exciting show of The Pelvic Messenger. My name is Alexandra Milspaugh, and today we're going to speak about the use of mindfulness in the treatment of sexual pain disorders, both within the realm of psychological counseling and pelvic floor physical therapy. Here to help us move this conversation forward is someone that has made it a point throughout her career to tap into the depths of both of these worlds around the world. Joining us from the other side of the world today is Tally Rosenbaum. Tally, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on this very special show.
Tally,
I think it's just so great how women who come together with these disorders and support one another, I think it's wonderful the power of that communal approach to dealing with sexual pain and with pelvic pain. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be part of that today.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the main parts of our mission here at Pelvic Messenger is to really help create that community, because certainly within the world of pelvic and sexual pain, it can be a very isolating experience and feel like you're the only one. So we're so happy that you could join us today. Today we are going to discuss one of Tally's recent articles entitled An Integrated Mindfulness-Based Approach to the Treatment of Women with Sexual Pain and Anxiety, Promoting Autonomy and Mind-Body Connection. This article was published in the Journal of Sexual and Relationship Therapy, and throughout the show we will also be welcoming any questions from those of you listening who wish to call in. The number to do that is 323-693-3847. Again, please feel free to join our conversation today, and you can call us at 323-693-3847. Tally earned a master's in clinical sociology and counseling and a certificate in mental health studies from the University of North Texas. She also has a bachelor's degree in physical therapy from Northwestern University. Tally is the only ASEX-certified sex therapist who is an individual and couples therapist, as well as a pelvic floor physical therapist, and is an internationally recognized expert on the treatment of sexual pain disorders. She has authored over 20 peer-reviewed journal articles and several book chapters on sexual health, unconsummated marriage, and sexuality in Judaism. You can learn more about Tally on her website at www.tallyrosenbaum.com. Again, thanks so much for being with us today, Tally. It's an honor to have you on the show. In your recent article...
Thank you, and thanks for that lovely introduction.
Oh, yes. In your recent article, you discussed some criticisms of the what they call the biopsychosocial treatment model within the realm of treating sexual pain disorders. Can you describe what the biopsychosocial approach is for our listeners and some of those criticisms you mentioned?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I want to go back just a little bit in history. When it comes to sexual pain, there was traditionally this kind of either-or approach. In other words, women would, and many women today I'm sure can still relate to this experience, women would complain of having pain, whether pelvic pain or vaginal pain, painful intercourse or other painful conditions, and would go to the doctor. Sometimes they would go to several doctors, especially if we're dealing with pelvic pain that has symptoms which involve more than one system. So, you know, you might have gone to the urologist with some symptoms of urinary issues, and then go to a gynecologist and a gastroenterologist. And the approach was always, well, let's first look for what's wrong physically. Let's first see if this is a pelvic pain or sexual pain condition, which is organic. And if after we go through all of these medical examinations, we are not able to have any kind of determination of findings, then our understanding is that this pain is psychological. It's a psychological pain that's in her head. And this is a very difficult and outdated, by the way, model, because it pathologized women. First of all, by the time they were finished seeing about 12 different doctors on average, you know, that in itself can cause a great deal of psychological distress, just trying to figure out what's wrong with you. And so today we've gone away from that kind of either-or approach. If you're hearing any practitioners out there saying, well, let's see if this is physical, and if not, maybe it's psychological, that's just not the way the biopsychosocial approach is. The biopsychosocial approach, which I will delineate some criticism about, but in general, it's a great approach, is an approach that appreciates that there are physical factors as well as psychological factors, as well as social factors, which all work together in the presentation of pelvic pain and of vulvodynia and other sexual pain disorders, and really all pain disorders, because pain affects your life. It affects your family life. It affects your social life. It does cause or contribute to or is correlated with often mood issues, anxiety, depression, fatigue. And it's certainly going to involve changes in your identity as a person and your role identity and your function and what you do and your profession. And so we need to be able to address all the different issues involved in pain. And so the biopsychosocial paradigm allows us to look at pain from a multidisciplinary perspective. So that's just a little bit of the background on what it means by the biopsychosocial model. To answer your next question, you asked me, you know, what's wrong with that? Why am I criticizing that model? That seems like an excellent way to view sexual pain and pelvic pain, and you know, you look at it from all points of view, and it's very holistic. And with that, I would say I have to absolutely agree. But I'm going to explain why I presented these criticisms and why I wrote this article. What happens is this is a multidisciplinary approach. So what happens is that in the clinical setting, every discipline has its attributed area of focus. So according to the biopsychosocial model, in the presentation of pelvic pain issues, it is the physician who is in charge of the medical part, and it is the psychotherapist or other mental health professional who is in charge, so to speak, of the psychological part, and that will include anxiety, depression, issues with a partner, and treatment to address distress, mental health variables. And in this model is also the physical therapist. The physical therapist is also a very important part of the multidisciplinary team that treats pelvic pain, and the area that the physical therapists are designated to address is, as we all know, the pelvic floor. So according to this model, while the doctors treat the physical aspects, give the creams and the medications and ask the questions about symptoms, the mental health professional is the one who deals with the psychological aspects, and the physical therapist says, okay, let's deal with the musculoskeletal aspects and the pelvic floor. So why is this a problem? Well, number one, it's a very compartmental model, and what I mean by compartmental is when people walk into the treatment room, they're not walking in with only their sense of self musculoskeletally or only their sense of self psychologically, meaning that for the treating practitioner, they need to have an appreciation of the entire, you know, the whole being. Now, while the multidisciplinary approach is understood to work in an interdisciplinary manner such that the psychologist could dialogue with the physical therapist, who could dialogue with the doctor, what actually is the challenge is that when we're dealing with, for example, something as basic as pelvic examination and treatment. So pelvic examination and treatment is something that the psychologist or the sex therapist does not do. The psychologist or the sex therapist is in an office, and the office is a pretty safe place. There's no bed in there. There are no gloves in there. There's no gel in there. There's nobody's going to examine you in there. And so that's a very safe and contained place to talk about anxiety and stress and depression and relationships. When you go into the physical therapy room, and that is where you're treating your pelvic floor, it's the place which is the most likely to trigger anxious reactions. And so physical therapists are great at what they do, and I love physical therapists, and I've been a physical therapist for many, many years before I transitioned and studied psychotherapy. But, and medical doctors, by the way, are not typically well-trained in even recognizing signs of dissociation, which is a common occurrence, or in necessarily knowing how to deal with revelations of sexual abuse or flashbacks or PTSD, or even the simple, very, very anxious woman who is very conflicted about being examined. On the one hand, she wants to be examined, but on the other hand, she's very, very, very afraid, and she doesn't really know what to do. And the physical therapist may not necessarily know how to properly relate to those situations. Mental health professionals, on the other hand, may want to offer behavioral advice. They want to be able to help on the level of, well, you know, try this and try that. But they're not the ones examining, so they have no idea. They're the ones, you know, they don't know what dilators or inserts to provide or what exercises for the pelvic floor to provide. So that's the basic criticism. It's not so much of a criticism as much as recognizing a need to enhance the knowledge and clinical skill set of physiotherapists who deal with patients who are anxious and who have some need for counseling or some mental health intervention within the physical therapy intervention. So I just talked for a really long time. Is that clear? Did I make sense?
Yes, yes, and I think you make a lot of really important points, not only for any folks out there that are listening who are experiencing pelvic pain, but also as well as providers, because I hear you talking about cross-training, basically, and the importance of seeking out providers that have a little bit of that. So not only physical therapists that have some training or awareness on how to respond and recognize to dissociation, to trauma, to when they're triggering their patients within that treatment room, but also for counselors and sex therapists to have a relationship with physical therapists as well as to have a knowledge of the body and a knowledge of the ligaments, because I think in both worlds they're not being trained in that other world. You know, the counselors aren't being trained in
exactly.
The physical piece, the biological piece, and the folks such as the doctors and the physical therapists, they're not being trained in the psychosocial piece. And so I think in this effort of creating this community, we really need to work on building relationships, not only among the patient population, but also within the provider population to really share this information.
Right. Right, exactly. The mindfulness-based protocol is one that I developed as a result of that need. And what the mindfulness-based protocol does is it really addresses the psychosocial aspects while also allowing provision of the necessary physical therapy interventions or other medical interventions or other treatment interventions, even sex therapy interventions. In other words, the mindfulness protocol is also appropriate for sex therapists to use in instructing their clients on certain activities and exercises to do.
Can you describe what your definition of mindfulness is? There are a lot of definitions and books out there. What definition and approach do you use? How would you describe that?
Okay, so it's not really so much about my personal definition. The mindfulness approach that I use is very much about I'll tell you first what it's not so much about. It's not so much about doing meditation, although certainly learning how to do relaxation techniques and meditation is important. But the mindfulness approach is really about being able to connect to the various dimensions of the experience of what the therapy is and what you're experiencing in this journey we call therapy and how we can experience it on different levels. So, for example, you experience the therapy on a cognitive level. You know, this is what I have to do. I am going to do my pelvic floor exercises or go to my physical therapist and have my pelvic floor muscles worked on, and I'm going to do it because I have to. It's what I have to do. And that's the cognitive part is a very judgmental part. It's a part of us that is very oriented towards what we should be doing. And it's also the part of us that is critical of our reactions. Why did I tighten my muscles like that? I know that I'm not supposed to do that. It's a very critical, it can be a very, very critical voice. So the idea is to connect with the sensory as well as the emotional aspects of what's going on with the treatment and not just the cognitive. Patients are encouraged to remember that when you feel pain, pain is a perception. It is a sensory feeling that doesn't necessarily have catastrophic implications. It's really just a sensation, and that sensation can pass. And so when we apply mindfulness in treatment, we're allowing an approach that addresses perceptions and feelings and attitudes and thoughts. And it allows the client to recognize how they sometimes use their cognitive judgments in a negative way. And what we want to do is we want to allow the client to focus on and accept what's going on with them, how they're feeling, not just what they're thinking about what they should be doing. And so this connects them, even during the treatment, this connects them to whatever feelings they might be having of anxiety or frustration or shame or exposure or sadness or all kinds of things that once they're focused on what's going on with them emotionally and physically as well as just in their thinking, then they can be much more connected to themselves and they'll be less likely to disconnect, to disassociate. I'm going to give you like an example, and it might sound a little bit critical, and it's not my intention to criticize any colleagues because I think that, as I said again, physical therapists are amazing. But I've had occasion to see clients who have stressed treatments whereby they were very, very painful physical therapy treatments. And when I would ask what their experience was in the treatment, they said, well, we would talk about different things in order to distract me from the pain. We talked about what was on Mad Men last night, or she would talk about her date with her boyfriend. And, you know, it was like friendly kind of discourse. And after that, I would need to, you know, the next day I couldn't move for a day, but I know that this is what I need. And it sounds to me like situations like that should be avoided because you're not focused on the treatment. It's kind of like, here's my body. You know, do what you need to do with my body, and I might reconnect with my body tomorrow when it's in pain. So we want to really make sure that our clients are present when we're working with them, and that we're not asking them to tolerate the pain by thinking about something else. That's counterintuitive to the type of therapy atmosphere that I'm attempting to promote in this article as well as in my workshops and trainings.
Right, and that's great because I think that's important in both the physical therapy room as well as the counseling room as far as that awareness of the sensation, not only the thoughts, which builds on cognitive behavioral therapy. One of the things you mentioned in your article is how a lot of, you know, most sex therapists many, utilize cognitive behavioral therapy. And I think mindfulness, and you had mentioned this, really builds on that concept. So it's not only just focusing in on the cognitive piece, but on all of the sensory pieces and trying to avoid avoidance. So within the counseling realm, some people are encouraged to, okay, let's quickly get away from anger, let's quickly get away from sadness, and let's figure out how to rush right into peace or rush right into happiness, when it's almost discouraged to sit with the pain. And same with the physical pain. It's discouraged to kind of allow yourself to sit with the physical pain because I think there's a fear that it won't end. So there's a constant running away from it.
Right. Look, I think we also need to acknowledge and recognize that there is a therapeutic relationship that occurs with therapists, with psychotherapists and clients that doesn't necessarily occur with physical therapists and with medical practitioners, such that there is a certain disconnect because, after all, you're working in the most incredibly intimate part of the body. So there does have to be this sort of like, okay, we're doing this, but we're not really doing this. So if you think about when you go to the gynecologist, you're not like looking into the gynecologist's eyes and connecting. You're kind of like thinking about when this is going to be over so that you can get dressed and leave. Nobody really, you know, there's a certain amount of disconnection, which I think is normal. But what happens is often is that practitioners are very cognitively focused people themselves. They have goals. They have, you know, a clock that's ticking and they need to accomplish. They have other clients waiting for them, and they want to be able to help their clients, and they get frustrated. They get frustrated themselves. And, you know, so if somebody comes in and says, I didn't do any of my exercises, you know, they might not know to say, well, let's talk about that. What are the exercises? You know, what did they bring out in you? What did, you know, what did you feel when you thought about doing the exercises? What they might say, well, look, you know, if you don't do your exercises, I don't really see how we can progress, for example.
Right.
You know, not in a mean way, but just in a very matter-of-fact way. Now, for example, that recognition that the woman is experiencing her own conflict that we could actually help them with sometimes is lacking. And so what I was hoping to do would be to increase as much as possible that awareness by really providing the therapist an opportunity to journey with their clients through what's going on with them cognitively, as well as in their emotions and in their feelings and in their sensations. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that while nobody likes a pelvic exam, there are women who come to physical therapists, and many of them even bypass psychological therapy because they're really focused on, you know, I have a physical condition. It's called pelvic floor dysfunction. My problem is with my pelvic floor. I love my partner and we get along really well, and the problem is physical, you know, and it is physical, and they do have pelvic floor dysfunction. But the idea of treating pelvic floor dysfunction as a mechanical, isolated entity misses out, because what happens is that the pelvic floor, if the woman really is anxious about examination or she does feel exposed, the pelvic floor will contract even more. I mean, we know that the pelvic floor contraction is often an expression of an emotional state. The pelvic floor reacts to pain, reacts to anxiety. And so if we're not addressing what is the client's experience around the pain and around the anxiety, then we're just trying to relax a muscle and not relax, you know, her, and not address what's going on in her. So I would point out that this is particularly an issue with women who have been diagnosed as vaginismus. So even though that term is debatable, I'm not going to get into a debate about it, but that woman that comes into the physical therapist who's really, really anxious about being examined. And this is the case with doctors as well. I've heard a lot of stories of women who have been told really awful things by doctors, like, you know, how are you, you know, open your legs, what's wrong with you? You know, men don't like that. Or, you know, I don't understand how your, what a saint your husband is that he even stays with you. I mean, wow. Or, what are you so uptight about? Babies come out of there. They're judgmental. And, you know, women will take that, obviously, in a very, very bad way, because they're really awful, judgmental things to have to hear. And it misses the point of a woman who is coming in for help. She's coming in, and believe me, you know, I'm sure anybody who's had this knows that it is not a small thing for them to come into a physical therapist or for a doctor and expose themselves that way and say, you know, there are knives in my vagina, or there's burning in my vagina, or I have pain, or I can't allow intercourse. And, you know, it's very exposing, and so they're very vulnerable as it is. But they really want to get on that table and open their legs because they want to do what's right. They want to do what's expected of them. That, by the way, is the social part of the biopsychosocial model, which, remind me, I'd like to talk about a little bit too. But I do want to talk about the existential conflict. The existential conflict is that the woman is coming into a physical therapist wanting and expecting to be examined, but she doesn't always realize that she's not ready for it. And the physical therapist may not necessarily know that. And if she's disconnecting, that might even seem like this kind of acquiescence agreement. But you see, what has brought her to where she is in the first place has a lot to do with this inability to say no, this inability to set boundaries. And so she's coming in and saying, I need to be examined, so fine, I'll be examined. But she's feeling a lot of anxiety, but the whole time she's very busy pushing her anxiety down, pretending it's not there, ignoring it. And so she'll get on the table, and then at the last minute, the physical therapist goes to examine, and then she closes her legs, and she's very, very tight. And that results in frustration for the patient and for the therapist. She feels, the patient feels she has failed. The therapist feels like, you know, I don't really know what to do. I can't really get my finger in here. She'll say, you know, why don't you try to take some deep breaths? It's really not so bad. And the irony of all this is that by the time the therapist puts her finger in, she says, oh, you have a very tight pelvic floor. Well, yeah. she's in a state of fight or flight. Of course her pelvic floor muscles are tight. We know from various studies that have been done that pelvic floor muscles respond to threat. By the way, not just sexual threat. In one study that was done in the Netherlands, women were shown scary films, and the pelvic floor muscles went crazy. So the ability to recognize with, together with your client, when she can be really present and mindful, that's when we can start with the physical intervention. Very, very often, physical interventions are begun too early. And, you know, they first need to be external interventions before they should be internal interventions. And those internal interventions should only be done when the client is really able to contain that amount of exposure and that amount of ability to be in an unaroused state. When I say aroused, I don't mean sexually aroused. I mean in terms of the
sure,
the nervous system. And so the other thing I want about the biopsychosocial model, which really is an important place for medical practitioners as well as mental health practitioners to be aware of, is the social piece. And the social piece is that place of women are expected to, quote-unquote, provide intercourse. It is part of their role. And this causes them to feel pathologized, that they can't function in their role in the same way that somebody who's had a stroke feels pathologized for not being able to be a homemaker anymore or a secretary anymore or a doctor anymore. And so it becomes society's role identity for women. Instead of talking about pleasure, instead of talking about connection, instead of talking about mutual satisfaction, we're so focused on intercourse that the woman feels that she has to do these treatments because, you know, she has to provide for her partner or he's going to leave her. There's very strong social pressure, and sometimes therapists and doctors perpetuate that by colluding with all the other voices that say to her, to be a real woman, you have to get this dilator in. You have to get the next size in, and then you can get your boyfriend or husband in, and won't everybody be so proud of you? And it's an infantilizing of
the
woman.
Very performance-oriented.
And this is very performance-oriented, but it's also very oriented towards an activity that, by the way, developmentally, this particular woman may or may not be ready for. There are plenty of women with pelvic pain who very much want to have intercourse. There's no question that many listening will say, okay, enough of the outer core stuff. You know, I want to have sex. I want to have penetration. I used to be able to, and it was great, or I've never been able to, but I want to. I want to be normal. I want to be like everybody else. And so for those women, then, you know, there's certainly a great deal of motivation. And, you know, there's absolutely no problem with wanting to be able to figure out as much as possible how to get to that, but not as this performance-oriented place, but as, you know, as a journey. But then what about the women who really don't feel any connection to intercourse? They can or maybe don't have pleasure in other ways, but they just feel very pressured. And they hear these messages like their poor husband is going to leave. And many of the women that I see are from very traditional societies. They haven't had intercourse before marriage. They're expected to have intercourse on their wedding night. They're terrified for whatever reason. Sometimes there hasn't been such an intimacy established with their partners. And, you know, this approach of, you know, manipulating the genitals to make them bigger, to allow intercourse for the husband, and providing a lot of, you know, like cheerleading along the way, robs her of her autonomy. You know, what we want to do is really promote autonomy at the same time as we really want to help her be able to be sexual, to be able to express herself sexually, be able to, you know, talk about what feels good for her, but also to be able to put boundaries. Because once she's able to put boundaries in a verbal way and believe that it is her right to do so, she'll be less likely to need to contract her muscles in order to do it. You know, she views that first intercourse as a huge, monumental, and scary event, a one-time big deal event that once it goes in there, she has no more control. And there's a lot of fears. If we're talking about fears and thoughts and emotions, this is where the cognitive behavioral stuff comes in, because her emotion, her fears or her thoughts are catastrophic. You know, I'm going to bleed, or it's going to go in there and it's not going to be able to come out. It's going to get stuck in there. It's going to break my hymen. It's going to, you know, there's a lot of these, you know, or if I don't let him, you know, he's going to leave me, and I'm never going to be a mother. These kind of, you know, cognitive distortions that we can certainly learn to use to help our clients with cognitive behavioral methods, but the mindfulness techniques, in addition to those methods, really allows the person to connect with those thoughts, to recognize when she's having those thoughts, to recognize when she's having those judgmental, critical things that she says to herself, like, you know, oh, I'm so stupid, I'm such a baby, I can't believe I put my legs together, I really didn't want to, I really need to be able to do this. And those are all, you know, the emotions behind those thoughts are anxiety. It's really about anxiety and fear and not feeling in control. And what we don't want to do is we don't want to try to convince her that she needs to give up control. So the doctors and therapists that say, you know, why don't you try a glass of wine, or why don't you just kind of like, you know, breathe deep and just let him, or, you know, whatever it is that they make them feel that they just need to be submissive and passive, isn't going to work. We need that autonomy.
Absolutely. And would you be able to review some specific mindfulness techniques that you recommend for these individuals who are navigating these, you know, social pressures and expectations?
Yeah, sure. So I can talk about techniques that have to do with treatment, so that both patients who are listening and practitioners who are listening might be able to benefit. My mindfulness-based protocol, for example, starts with assessing what are my thoughts, feelings, and sensations just as I sit here today. Like, if somebody comes in, and again, now people, I see couples and I see patients as a sex therapist, but when I was developing this protocol, people were coming in to me for physical therapy. And they would come in expecting to be examined, and that conflict would be very clear, because a woman would be sitting there, and she'd be sitting at the end of her chair, and her body language would spell out very, very strongly that she's extremely contracted and extremely anxious all over her body, yet she would say, okay, let's just get this over with, you know, let's do this. And then I'll say to her, you know, wait a second, can we just sit here for a moment and let's just kind of go through what you're feeling in your body? And that would be the sensations aspect of it. And then she might say, well, I kind of feel this tightness in my chest, or I feel my heart pounding. And so this connects her to, you know, what she, you know, is she really ready to get up? You know, she might get up and walk towards the table, and I'll say, wait a second, stop for a second. What is going on in your body? And what is going on in your mind? And what is going on in your emotions? And it becomes very clear that she's, you know, and that's usually the point where they, like, completely, you know, turn into themselves, you know, like their real, their true self, you know, like, okay, you know, I'm going to stop putting on this show of the good patient, and now I get to be who I really am. I'm terrified of getting on that table for another truth. I'm only doing this because my husband made me, or I really don't want to be here. And it's so important, because I don't want them to be doing something. I don't want to be another person who exposes them. I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be another person who uses, like, distraction techniques to stick something in them when they don't really want anything in them. I mean, it's hard. It's hard for physical therapists sometimes, you know. It's like they don't want to be the one to do. And so it was really, really important for me, for my own mental health, to not be doing that. I mean, I just had to make sure that there was not just verbal acquiescence, yes, this is what I want to do, but, you know, are you ready to do this? So the mindfulness protocol has the woman, you know, first start at home with just laying on her bed and opening her legs. Now, be very, very cognitive. They're going to look at the program and they're going to say, oh, I can do this. I have no problem opening my legs. But when they're really asked to feel what's going on in them, they might find that with increasing exposure, because it's first with your clothes on, then with, like, your underwear on, you know, that's with a sheet on you, without a sheet on you. So it's a very gradual protocol which slowly exposes you. And as they get into greater levels of exposure, they do begin to connect with where the anxiety begins. And when they can feel their anxiety at a very low level, allow themselves to feel it, allow themselves to contain it, allow themselves to breathe with it, be with it, stop judging it, stop attempting to, make it go away, ignoring it, they can then learn to contain it and maybe be okay with it and then go on to the next level. And then the next level would be, okay, now let's do these exercises in the clinic. And then, first imagine doing them in the clinic. So by the time you get to the examination, your client is present with you. You know, you're able to look at her in the eye. You know if she's dissociating or not. And by the way, her pelvic floor muscles by then are going to be a lot easier to, you know, they'll be a lot more relaxed because she's comfortable and relaxed and knows that there's always a place to go back to. There's always a place where she can say, wait, stop. She's got the control. So that would be one way of using mindfulness. Another way that I use mindfulness, and I have several examples, but is in the work with dilators. Now, I'd like to talk for a few moments about vaginal dilators. There isn't a lot of literature. Yeah, there isn't a lot of literature. And then when I talk about the dilators, I can then talk about the mindfulness-based approach to dilators. There really doesn't exist a lot of literature about how women perceive vaginal dilators. Well, we have our studies that, you know, vaginal dilators began when they began with the original sex therapists, maybe in the 60s or 70s, and I don't know the exact history of the dilator. I mean, I probably did know it once, but, you know, it's a pretty standard treatment. It's standard treatment for quote-unquote vaginismus or women who are unable to allow penetration, so you gradually build up and you decrease the anxiety and you increase the ability to contain larger and larger inserts until you can have intercourse easily without pain, et cetera. They have very high rates of success in the literature, yet there's almost no literature at all on how women feel about the dilators. What are the perceptions of women who have to use dilators? Well, I've not collected data in any formal way, but I have worked with women, you know, I'm a physical therapist for 30 years, I'm a sex therapist for several years, and my field of expertise has been severe sexual pain disorders. So I can tell you from that, and I can also tell you from one study that was done on women with cancer who had to use dilators, that women consider the dilators embarrassing, mechanical, uncomfortable, and very often resent them. You know, they resent that little bit. I had women that will come in after working with dilators, and I'll say, where are your dilators? And they said, you know, one day I just threw them out in the trash. I hate them so much. And, you know, we're not asking those questions about how women perceive dilators. So what I thought to myself about the vaginal dilators is that, you know, women are going home, they're sticking these things in themselves, and then they're trying to reconcile that with being romantic and sexy with their partners, and they're having a very hard time doing that, and that's very understandable. And then I started thinking, you know, we know about physiology, right? We know that a man who is expected to have sexual intercourse with his partner would not be able to do so if he were not erect, right? I mean, you can't have a penis go into a vagina when it's flaccid. So it's almost a given that when a man is going to have sexual intercourse with a woman, and I apologize for being so heterosexist today. I don't mean to not include the many women with pelvic pain who may have female partners, but for now, we're talking about a penis. So we know that men get aroused, and it's their physical arousal, which is generally a pleasurable act, that allows them to be physically prepared to engage in sexual intercourse. However, you know, we don't often tell women, and it's certainly not very well demonstrated or very well stressed in sexual education, where mostly what's stressed is prevention of disease and prevention of pregnancy. We don't stress women's pleasure. We don't say, well, you know, before you allow intercourse, your body physiologically prepares for intercourse with a process called arousal, which also involves genital arousal. So in order for you to be ready for the penis to enter, or for anything to enter really, you know, the understanding is that you would be lubricated, you would be, your vagina would somewhat get a little bit wider as part of that process. Yes, there are some pelvic floor contractions, but those are little contractions. They don't close the vagina. That's okay. They just increase blood flow to the clitoris. So, you know, I got to thinking, well, why do these dilators in this kind of, you know, disconnected, watching TV, not really connecting to your body state, when you can put your body into a state of genital arousal, and that's certainly a lot more fun and physiologically normative. So what I do with the dilators is that rather than make it into like this punishment homework that women hate to do, I say first, you don't even have to use the dilators, but like first make sure that you're doing this kind of, you know, this is mindfulness. This is, you know, you create a space. Mindfulness is also creating a space that does not involve screens, a screen-free environment. So you create a screen-free environment, and you're just with yourself, and you can make it very sensual. So use your senses. Light some scented candles. Be in a room that's like yours, that feels relaxing and safe to you. Maybe put on some music and start off this as, you know, this is my time to myself. This is my opportunity to connect with myself, with my body, my sexuality, and not, you know, my husband's going to be mad at me if I don't try and work with the dilators tonight. But really this is about my gift that I can give myself to be connected. And then once I'm doing that, I can then go on to self-pleasuring and connecting to what those changes are in my genitalia. Because, you know, women come in and, you know, I'm sure that you've heard this, and I'm sure that many of our practitioners who are, many of our listeners who are practitioners have heard this, and I'm sure that some of our listeners who are patients may connect to this. But we have patients that come in and say, look, I don't even have to like it. I just want to be able to do it without suffering, right? And, you know, that's like, when I hear that, I feel so bad because, you know, that again points to the role aspect. And, you know, how can you turn something painful into something, you know, pleasurable unless you focus on the pleasure. And, you know, it used to be like, okay, well, let's at least make this neutral, and then maybe I can start enjoying it. But, you know, that doesn't always work that way, because your body's connections have already associated intercourse with pain for such a long time. So you first have to really make new connections. You know, can I get myself aroused and then, you know, put a finger inside or put a very small insert inside and feel that I can continue to connect to my pleasurable sensation even while I'm being aware of an unpleasant sensation. I'm pausing,
yes,
so that
please.
You can ask me more questions and I can take a sip of water.
No, this is wonderful. I mean, you're really giving great examples and great just simply concepts of how to approach healing, not only outside the bedroom, but inside the bedroom, so to speak, not, you know, and the importance of utilizing mindfulness, meaning utilizing the practice of being aware, not only with the thoughts, but with all of the sensory pieces and experiences that are going on for somebody, and how that gives permission to be as they are, gives permission to notice, gives permission to be as they are, and to not what's going on in the mind, in the body, in the spirit, in that sense of connection or disconnection, and to really regain that control. And to, because I think, as we were talking about in the beginning of the show, there's so much control that's taken from these women and men that have pelvic and sexual pain. You know, the doctor's in charge of the medications and the ointments, as you said, and the therapist is in charge of these interventions, and the physical therapist is in charge of, okay, let me show you these exercises to do. And it's very much almost instilled in them as far as this external locus of control. And I think mindfulness really helps bring that control back into their own bodies and says, oh, wait, I can be the captain of this ship. I can guide this journey.
Absolutely.
And when I'm ready.
Yeah.
And recognizing when they're ready, because I think you also made a fabulous point that cognitively they might say, yes, I'm ready. I'm ready to do this. I'm ready to get better. I'm ready to heal. But there's a part of them that perhaps is not, not that they don't want to heal, but it's simply not ready for that huge step. And mindfulness can really help break those steps up.
Right. Mindfulness is a great tool for the practitioner as well as for the patient, because it can allow the practitioner to also be aware of what's going on in her or him. Because there, you know, even though in a traditional sense we don't talk about transference and countertransference in the physical therapy room, there is a connection, there is a relationship, especially with pelvic floor physical therapy. You know, it's the most intimate area, and pelvic floor physical therapists, amongst all physical therapists, are the most likely to be really confronted with very intimate details of women's lives, to be asked all kinds of questions, and to think, and to also be the ones to provide the suggestion that perhaps sexual counseling or relationship therapy or some other sort of mental health intervention may be appropriate. And even doing that requires a certain amount of awareness of what is the best way to do things. So when you were talking about locus of control, I was thinking about how, you know, when I did my own personal journey, even as a sex counselor / physical therapist to sex therapist or to therapist, you know, using the IT, the intensive therapy within the PLICIT model, the permission and limited information and specific suggestions, that focus is very much, you know, therapist-centered as opposed to client-centered. You know, you have a protocol. You have information that you want to give. You have a treatment that you want to provide. And, you know, no two clients are alike. Each client is going to come with her own narrative and her own dynamics in her home and in her relationships. And so that's sort of a mindfulness-based approach would be kind of like beginner's mind. If you've, you know, beginner's mind is a principle in mindfulness, which is that, you know, you don't ever have the same experience twice and don't anticipate having the same experience twice. You know, be really open. Be really open to just listening to what your client has to say, and not expecting that the treatment that you did with them last week is going to parallel in any way the treatment that you're going to do with them this week, because they might be in a completely different place. And that's a good message for the client as well. I do want to just stop for 1 second and warn you that in probably a minute and a half, my phone will automatically disconnect. So okay. I can call you right back before that happens in the middle of the sentence, and therefore we don't have to have that discomfortable moment where disappear. So if it's okay to take a minute break and maybe you have a commercial, I can call you right
Absolutely.
Back.
Absolutely. Okay, great, Kylie. Thank you.
Okay, great. I will call you right back. Bye-bye.
To folks who are just started listening in or recently, we are joined today by internationally renowned sex therapist and physical therapist, Tali Rosenbaum, who is speaking on her use of mindfulness in her approach to treating sexual pain disorders. Certainly, if you'd like to join the discussion, if you have any questions, you can call in at 323-693-3847. And right now, because she is joining us from the other side of the world, she did have to disconnect for a certain period of time, and she will be right back with us. So again, the folks who just started listening in, we are joined today by internationally renowned sex therapist and pelvic floor physical therapist, Tali Rosenbaum, who is speaking on her use of mindfulness and her approach to treating sexual pain disorders, not only within the counseling room, but also within the physical therapy room. And she is joining us from the other side of the country today, which we are honored to have her on the show. And so she's currently taking a quick one-minute break because she has to call right back in. And here she is. Thank you again.
I'm back.
Okay, Tali, thank you.
Hello.
Yes, you're back on.
I'm back, yes.
How might couples, and if you were in, I apologize, did you have more to say on what you were just commenting on?
Can you remind me what we were talking about? I'm sorry.
Sure, sure.
I don't remember what
Basically, the use of permission and regaining that control and taking their time in
So we were talking about beginner's mind. Yeah, and just to finish that, about this mindfulness principle of beginner's mind, is that what's different from mindfulness than traditional physical models is that traditional physical therapy model really focus on goal orientation. You know, if you're you know, walking with somebody and you're teaching them to walk after an accident, for example, you know, if you walk 50 meters one day, or yards, because it's an American program, then you want 55 or 60 the next day, and every day you're going to want to do better or more than the day before. A beginner's mind is really kind of being open to whatever happens today, that just because, you know, you did this much, you know, let's say you already achieved the third dilator, you don't need to anticipate that you're going to go on to the fourth today. You might even just be able to get to the second, and that's okay because that's where you're at today. And, you know, lest I hear from physical therapists that, well, you're not going to get anywhere that way, that hasn't been my experience, actually. You know, I've been pretty successful at helping get couples to where they want to be without pushing goals or achievements orientation. That was
right,
all I wanted to say about that.
And I think that's really important for, again, not only patients but providers that are listening to really hear, because I think some of, particularly I think physical therapists and counselors are under the pressure of, with insurance companies, of needing to show improvement. So I think they might be feeling this external pressure of,
improve. Let's show that it's working. Let's show that things are moving. And they, in turn, put that pressure on to the client. But that, in fact, can slow down, if not reverse, healing, because that's just added pressure to get to a certain point that they might not be ready for.
Right. Exactly.
How might some couples that are navigating the sexual pain disorders use mindfulness as a way to increase sensuality and intimacy in their relationship?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I as a sex therapist, will often give certain, I don't like to call them exercises, but experiences for couples to try at home. They are a combination of some different, you know, some traditional sensate-focused type exercises, which are about focusing on touch and, you know, starting out with non-genital touch and taking all the focus off of intercourse. And but I've also made up some of my own, which involve other senses as well. And I'll ask the couples to also be very focused on their own experiences and how and their connection with each other. I want to give some credit here to Gina Ogden, because I very much, you know, I got hooked onto Gina after I already did the mindfulness protocol, and I realized how similar some of the approaches are in that sense of her. She has a wheel. It's called the Isis wheel. And in her wheel, she focuses on cognitive, sensory, you know, physical, emotional thoughts.
Spiritual.
Also, as well as, you know, what is the meaning? Spiritual. The fourth section is the spiritual. And, you know, me being me, and I'm not into, you know, spiritual so much, but I changed that to be like, what is the meaning for you? And it sometimes is spiritual, and it sometimes is very much about connection, and it sometimes is just about, I'm so happy that I was able to have an orgasm. You know, it's just something that hadn't happened for a long time because I was so focused on pain or my inability to have intercourse or my pain with intercourse. And so mindfulness is a very good way of being in the moment, not being focused on, you know, if I don't do this, then I can't do that. A good example that kind of is very, very common with couples is this kind of interaction whereby women with pelvic pain may avoid the kind of touch that they may actually very much want, need, and crave because they are afraid that any kind of physical affection will be interpreted as an invitation to have intercourse. I'm sure you've heard this, and I'm sure listeners have heard this, and this is something that you know, needs to be addressed with communication and needs to be addressed between the couple in terms of the ability to set boundaries. But what we want to do is we want to really get the couple to be refocused away from what they are not doing and focus them on what they would want to be doing and to do it, even if we don't want to include any painful activities in their sexual activity or their sensual activity. But to use mindfulness in those situations is really about not thinking about what's next. It's really about focusing on the here and now. Not thinking that if you're hugging, and what I like is there's a David Snarch technique called hug until relaxed. Where each person, where you hug your partner every day for a few moments, and you relax into the hug, and you're very focused on your own breathing, and it's meant to be a differentiation type of exercise, whereby you're relaxing yourself in it. You're not so focused on what your partner's necessarily doing. But the exercise is also very good for mindfulness because it's really about focusing on your own breathing, on your own emotions, grounding, really grounding yourself. It also provides other types of mindfulness-based advantages. That whole connection, trust, the ability to let go and stop trying to, control everything, just be, not necessarily, making everything into, well, what does it mean? What does it mean if he's touching me? It also really helps you focus. When you can live more in your body and not in your head, it improves your, awareness, your mental awareness, your attention span, your concentration. The other thing is that it decreases, what we call rumination. When you think about rumination is this place of, I'm just going to keep thinking about it and thinking about it and chewing it over. Why do I have this? Why is this happening to me? Why do I have to suffer? Why? And really just kind of stepping out of those thoughts and into your experience of letting go, just letting that go and not striving so much to be not in the place that you are, just accepting the place that you really, really are. And it really helps you to be patient. It helps you to be more patient with yourself and more patient with others. I think I heard once this quote that mental health begins with giving up all hope for a better past. I had a client once who she had an injury to her pelvic floor, to her vagina, a fissure, a cut, and there was a whole kind of thing that she did. Doesn't matter what. Something with a vibrator or sex, or I don't know, and it doesn't really matter, but that's what caused the injury. And, her focus was so much like going over and over, why did I do that? Just telling the story over and over and over again, as if telling the story over and over and over again were going to somehow help her. And really making it about letting that go, even if you need to do a ritual. Throw it into the sea, or, put it in a bottle and throw it into the sea. Right. Just don't visit that again. That is a mindfulness. That is a mindfulness technique. We can use visualization if we're working and we're not working, but if we're trying to, let's say, work with dilators or do some physical therapy techniques and we have a lot of anxiety, we can kind of breathe into the anxiety and maybe say, I'm having all these thoughts. What can I do with these thoughts? So you can put this mental image in your head of a box and taking all those thoughts and putting them into a box and saying, I'm just going to just kind of suck them up into this box for now and revisit them later. They'll still be there for me.
Well, this is really wonderful. I think you've gone over so many important points that I hope all listeners have found as helpful as certainly I have, because in my own practice of sex therapy and mindfulness, I'm constantly striving to do everything that you are talking about as far as not only providing specific techniques, but simply introducing mindfulness as a way of approaching life in general, let alone particularly approaching all these healing methodologies, be it with physical therapy, be it within the counseling realm, be it in the bedroom with a partner, or even with the bedroom by yourself. Mindfulness just really
is
such a beautiful approach in that sense of acceptance and permission and really love and compassion as to where you are now rather than constantly striving to be something different that can in and of itself bring up so much of that anxiety and past fears and past traumas.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think you definitely get it. And since you connect to this and you use these approaches in your practice as well, I think that you can certainly also appreciate how it can be used. It can be we can be introduced into the physical therapy treatment room. And I'm very, very invested in you know, kind of getting that message out. Please, let's listen to our clients. Please, let's improve our counseling skills. Let's learn about what empathy means, learn about what active listening means, learn about the narrative and how to listen to what the patient is telling you, because if you just stop talking to so much and sit down and listen, you know, that provides a lot more therapeutic benefit that you might than you might know. This is really stuff that physical therapists can do, and many of them, I'm sure, do. You know, mirror the patient when she tells you something, reflect it, you know, mirror it back and reflect on it. Ask her, you know, to tell you more about that. Make it open. It has been very important to me to have opportunities to teach counseling skills and to teach this mindfulness approach. We have an online course coming out in the next few months that is going to be that's designed for physical therapists to use a mindfulness approach. That's going to be marketed and sold by MedBridge in conjunction with Herman and Wallace. So I'm very excited about that for physical therapists who want to learn more about the mindfulness approach. I just got that from England, where I taught physical therapists, and looking forward to opportunities to do this in the future, including at the next combined sections meeting. For the APTA, the American Physical Therapy Association Women's Health section. So I think that the message is really beginning to get out there, and physical therapists are really getting more passionate counselors and really form this therapeutic relationship with their clients. It's really not just about, you know, strengthening muscles or loosening muscles, the manual techniques, and these are all very, very important, but also helping the client connect to herself as well as connecting with the client.
Yes. Yes, all around. Thank you so much, Tally. This has really been an honor to have you on the show. And again, if anyone listening would like to know more about Tally or to contact her, you can visit her website at www.tallyrosenbaum.com. Tally, again, thank you so much.
You can look for me on Facebook as well, Alexandra. Yeah, I was just going to invite people who would like to join my Facebook page. I have a Facebook page where I update people on all kinds of subjects having to do with sexual pain, so you can just look me up, Tally Y. Rosenbaum, and you'll most likely find my page.
Perfect. And I'll be sure to post that on our Facebook page as well, so people know how to get there even after this show ends today. And know for yourself as well as anyone listening that if you missed any of the conversation today, you can absolutely listen in. It's recorded and it's on the Pelvic Messenger website here, that they can listen into it at any time. Any final thoughts,
Great,
Tally?
Great. Well, I really want to say that I very much appreciate the opportunity to address this group and to speak with you, because you're also somebody whose work I very much admire and appreciate. I guess that if I have this opportunity to address, I would say, you know, the clients need to be empowered. You don't have to take it. In other words, if you've had a situation with a physician, or less likely to occur with a physical therapist, but if it did, I would say, you know, talk to them. Tell them what your experiences were, if you felt exposed, if you felt uncomfortable. It's a good way to be able to feel more in control of what has happened. And it's also a really good way to get the message out there that women, you know, need to be listened to, that their symptoms need to be listened to and validated. And I think that the power of this group is one step in that direction. So I really want to thank you for allowing me to be here, and I want to wish a great health and great relationships to all the listeners.
Wonderful. Oh, thank you so much, Tally. It's been such a pleasure.
You're very welcome. Okay, great. Okay. Take care. Bye,
yes,
everybody.
Yes, have a beautiful day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.